world. This is Paper Cuts with Brad and Jay.
We'll just get this out of the way here. Thanks for joining us on Brad's show.
Yeah, thanks for coming to my show. I did not say shenanigans. Okay.
Are you drinking already?
No, I've just got water. Just got water. Always looking smooth, aren't you?
Yeah, I do it. I try to clean out for the show. Look, one of us has to. Come on.
In this episode of Paper Cuts, we are joined by Katriana Ward. We are live.
Oh, hello there, everyone. Welcome to a special Saturday edition of Paper Cuts. Now, normally, when we have a Saturday edition, that means we're going overseas, and we're joined by a friend that's normally overseas. But this time, our guest happens to be in the States. So how confusing is that? What's up, everyone? That's Brad over there. My name is Jay. Before we introduce the guest, I just want to say Brad has not slept for like a month because he's been so excited about this.
Been pumped.
This show. So to change things up a little bit, Brad, you do the honors of introducing our guest this time. I'm excited too, but Brad has not slept, just for the records, okay?
So, just been full of jitters the whole time.
A lot of coffee.
So I'm gonna butcher your first name, even though you told me how to say it. So I'm going to just say Kat Ward, because I've said it Katrina and Katriona, and I don't think either one of those is right.
It's actually, it's really difficult. It's Katriana with a sort of
Katriana.
Katriana. Yeah, there you go. Perfect. You did it.
There you go. Thanks. I can copy.
So I messed up the intro, basically, is what you're telling me. So I said it the way that it sounded, or the way that it looked like it was the right way. So.
So we have Katrina. See, I'm already messing it up. Well, Katrina Ward.
So I mispronounce it all the time, just so that people can know how to say it.
You mispronounce your own name.
All the time, yeah.
So she's the author of The Girl from Robwood, The Last House on Needless Street, which is just a mind-blowing book, Sundial, and the brand new Little Eve. I guess kind of brand new, but not brand new since it's a re-release, but brand new from Tor Nightfire in the States now. So welcome, Kat. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Yeah, it's very exciting about Little Eve because it's sort of a second life for the book. You know?
Yeah.
It came out in the UK in 2018 and it did really, really badly. I mean, like terribly. Like oh, no. I've never seen a book do so badly. Like it sold minus copies. And then it had this wonderful second life where it got the Shirley Jackson Award. And then Nightfire had enough kindness to take it on as well after Needless Street. And it's amazing. It's like having a sort of, it's like what it's like is like looking at a photograph of yourself as a child because you're a completely different person now, you know, than you were when you wrote it. So
how does that work? Has anything changed in the book or is it still the original from 2018?
Well, they gave me the opportunity to change it, and I thought, no, I don't think I will. I corrected one error, I think, because I got something wrong about Gaelic, Scottish Gaelic, which is bad because it's set in Scotland. So I corrected that, but I decided not to change anything. I put there's a new foreword, which kind of contextualizes the book and talks about how things have changed for me since then, and also talks a little bit about the journey of the book itself. So that was fun to write. It was like it was quite emotional, actually, you know, revisiting those times and revisiting that particular book. But I decided not to change the text. No, I thought it is what it is. It's finished. You know?
Right. So
let's see.
I was going to say, so it actually came out before Needless Street, but so do you think the success of Needless Street kind of made people realize, hey, Little Eve is here and now it's revamped and ready to go? Did that help any, or am I way off with
definitely.
That?
Definitely. Oh, no, that's the whole reason, you know, despite it being, you know, no matter how much people like it, and some people did like it, no one can, you know, reasonably organize a new publication, a US publication for a book that's not really selling very well. So it was very, very, very much Needless Street that opened the door. Little Eve coming in, which was great, which is really great, and so nice because it's my second book, but it's pretending to be my fourth book. Yes, that's right. No, fifth book. Wait, how many books have I written?
You tell us.
it was my second book, and then Needless Street is my third, and then Sundial is my fourth. So it's my second book pretending to be my fifth book.
Right.
So with What do you think it was that was unpopular about it to begin with, like when it was released in the UK? Was it just bad timing or?
I don't think it was unpopular with readers. I think the publisher didn't really connect with it. It just happens sometimes, you know. And I was with a very, very quite hardcore, like, literary publisher. Okay. And I think that they were not entirely sure what to do with something that has, you know, I think most of my books have this middle of the Venn diagram between horror, thriller, mystery, literary, you know, and they don't necessarily easily sit on one particular shelf. And right. I think they were just a little puzzled as to what to do with me. So it didn't really get much exposure or marketing or anything like that. But, you know, and these things do happen with books. It's just, it's a business, isn't it?
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, and nowadays you have so many different publishers that are kind of blurring that line in between. Is this a mystery? Is this a thriller? Is this a dark fantasy? Is this horror? And they're going with everything. So yeah, I could definitely see a kick, you know, really getting big now because of all of the newer publishers we have from 2020 moving forward. So definitely. Yeah,
yeah. And you hardly see just like a straight up just horror or straight up sci-fi or fantasy. It's usually a mix of something nowadays. Everything's mixing together.
Well, mate, hasn't it always been, you know, like in a way, hasn't horror, I mean, horror's always, it's such a, like, an efficient parasite, horror. It draws from all of these different genres and absorbs them and sort of internalizes them and then spits them back out at you. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I for me, I think this feels like a natural progression. It's just maybe publishers are less afraid of the word horror. So they allow it into the mix a little bit more, which is delightful for me because I think horror, anyone who's ever heard me talk about anything knows that I find a way to bring into the conversation what an amazingly passionate and compassionate genre horror is and what incredible storytelling power it has.
Right.
Despite the fact it's often dumped at the bottom of the sort of genre hierarchy.
It is, which is horrible.
Yeah, because we were talking with Keelan Patrick Burke a few weeks back, and he agreed. Yeah. We were talking just about that itself, how a lot of publishers were used the term like thriller, you know. Or thriller,
dark fantasy.
Put everything in that, and some of the stuff you read under that genre, you're like, this is not thriller, this is horror. But they're afraid to say horror to minimize the audience. So, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's a strange thing because horror is and always has been incredibly popular and incredibly, as I was saying, an incredible expressive genre that talks about all these important things. You know, it talks about social justice and gender and power and like landscape and all of these amazing things. And yet, for some reason, people, you know, sort of slightly dunk on it. But anyway, not anymore.
Maybe at least it's too true. It could just be too true, too close to real life. You know, so.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good point because it, you know, it asks you to be uncomfortable and people don't necessarily want to be uncomfortable, but I think it's important. You know, it's weird because it, in a way horror has more integrity when it is genuinely making people uncomfortable and asking them to self-reflect and examine themselves than it is, you know, the things that people are much more comfortable with you know, someone getting beheaded on Game of Thrones.
Right.
Yeah. So do you ever have the you know, someone asks you what you do, and you, oh, I'm an author. What do you write? Horror. And they go, oh, you're the horror writer. I feel like that's common a lot, too. It's like, oh, you write horror. It's like, oh, that's not very good stuff.
Or maybe even family members are like, you know, afraid to approach you about things because of what you write, you know.
In case I'll put them in a book. Oh, yes. Yeah. And I do. So they should be afraid.
Yeah. That should be an honor. So it is for me. I'm in a couple of different books, and I'm so ecstatic about it. So I would love to be in anybody's book and get killed off. So.
Whose books are you in? That's amazing.
Should I do some name drops?
Yeah, yes. Name drops. Of course.
So there's a character in Laurel High Towers Below. That's after me.
Lovely.
There's a different name I went by in a Ross Jeffrey yet to be released book. Rebecca Rowland has me in a short story. So, Brad, what was that?
What's Ross's new book? The Devil's Pocketbook. Is that what it's called?
Yeah. Yeah, he just signed with somebody, and so now people could see that character die. Hopefully, a gruesome death. Yeah.
So, do you die in every one of these books?
That's the stipulation. That, you know, if they're going to use any kind of connection with me, I have to die a horrible death. So,
I mean, that's an honor to be killed off in a book.
Yeah, I'm in. My buddy in the UK, L. Stevenson, his the final part in his trilogy, which I got a first look at. I'm in that one, and I die a pretty gruesome death. So. I can't wait for that one to come out.
And Kat, you're in Stephen King's new book, aren't you? Is it that new one?
I wasn't going to bring it up, but then I thought, yeah.
Totally, bring it up, of course.
Yeah, because we got to talk about the whole, your connection with Stephen King and all this stuff. So yeah, come on, talk about that.
Well, I didn't know it was there. Someone tweeted a screenshot of the page at me, and I just started the book. I hadn't got to that part yet. But there's a cat called Katrina in fairy tale.
It's a black cat too, just like in Last House.
Just like Olivia. Yeah. I mean, I mean, it could, I suppose, just be that Katrina is a good name for a cat, but
that's too much of a coincidence. That's
no, totally because you have several blurbs by him now, so that's just too.
I do, yeah.
That's just too close to it. So,
and I think it was a little, as you say, a little Needless Street nod as well, a little black cat. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you can imagine what a moment that was. I think I saw it. I was in France, and I saw it at about 4 a.m. Just happened. You know, you wake up in the middle of the night and you glance at your phone, just like randomly. And I happened to see this, and God, I woke up quickly. I mean, I've never been so awake. So
shocked you awake.
And then spent the rest of the night like pacing and waiting for my partner to wake up so I could shout at him like.
That's awesome.
And, It was a huge moment. Stephen King along probably, you know, it was the Shirley Jackson Awards, and then Stephen King was probably the main turning point. But he changed my career. He changed my life. And he's wonderful at remaining engaged with the genre. And he reads and reads and reads and reads. I don't know where that man finds the time. But there's no sense of him pulling the ladder up behind him at all. I'll never stop being grateful. That will always have been my start. And what an honor, you know, as someone who's I've been reading his books ever since, in my teens. So amazing.
I remember an interview with him somewhere where he said he reads as much as he writes. And in order to be successful at writing, he has to read as much as he writes. So, yeah, he finds time to do both somehow.
You'll see him at a Red Sox game, and he'll have the book like during the innings.
Yeah. Wow. Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
That's dedication right there. That's.
Yeah. I mean, he had that terrible accident, didn't he, where he was walking along the side of a road reading.
Yeah, he got hit by that van.
Yeah.
Yeah, awful, really bad. But I mean, I've never, it's a strange thing because, you know, I feel exactly about the same way about Stephen King as I did when I was 13. Mm-hmm. And it's still, there's a massive cognitive disconnect for me that this person whose writing I have inhaled and who I think formed me as a writer and, you know, who I have a huge amount of admiration for is also the person who has not only apparently read my book, I've been kind enough to blurb it. I still haven't quite got my head around that.
Yeah. So you were a big King fan younger, growing up.
Of course.
Just absorbing everything.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know many horror writers who weren't.
Right.
He's the last blurb.
Yeah.
So how did that go about getting the blurb? Did you like have a list of people you'd like to have blurbs for? Did Tor Nightfire just send it out to whoever? Or?
It wasn't even Nightfire. It was before I got the Nightfire publishing deal. So it was just an independent press in the UK called Viper, who were part of Serpent's Tale, which is a wonderful publisher, one of the last few great kind of independents, not one of the big four. And it was coming out with them. And then a wonderful writer called Natasha Pulley tweeted about it, saying, "This is the best horror novel I've ever read." And Stephen King just replied to the tweet, at which everybody went absolutely bonkers. and then, because you think, I assume that there's some kind of like Harry Potter-style flu network for authors and publishers communicating with each other. But my editor rang me and she was like, "How do we get a book to Stephen King?" And I was like, "I don't know." because I think his tweet said, "I need it." Which is obviously a very funny play on words for Needless Street as well, but and nobody knew how to do it, and it took a little kind of like ringing around and sort of like putting our thinking caps on to do it, but we did. And then of course, just because he sends a tweet, he's not going to read it necessarily.
Right, he doesn't get 1,000 books each month, you know.
Exactly. So. Yeah. So there was no guarantee at all that he was. It is a bit like being sort of visited by some kind of fate or kind of God, because you're just like, you don't know when, you can't control it. You don't know when it's coming, and it's very much outside your control. It was a very wonderful and unusual experience. And then it happened again with Sundar. Oh, but that was over.
And now it's like, oh, it's two, you're good.
Like, okay. Yeah, that's yesterday's news. Obviously, let's get somebody new now.
I don't know if there's anyone bigger. Yeah. I mean,
I know.
I mean, really, for the horror, there's no one. And really, just books in general, I feel like if you just ask the average Joe who doesn't really read, name an author, probably 5 times, 9 times out of 10, they're going to say Stephen King.
Who would want to be the blurber after King? It's like you ask somebody to blurb, like, but you have Stephen King. Like, I'm down here. Why would you want, you know?
Well, maybe that's why I didn't get any other ones. No,
I know. It's like, I'm just Dean Koontz. What are you talking about?
Hamlin Bird has a question. Have you ever gotten to spoken with King, like personally in a message or anything? Or?
Never. There's a part of me that's so frightened, like in case I ever accidentally do meet him, I'm like, what the hell do I say to him?
Thanks for having my book.
Yeah, well, thanks for my book.
We were hoping you'd say that because backstage right now, I'm joking.
Oh, if he was backstage, I would just have a heart attack.
Yeah, you guys. I feel like you wouldn't have led with anything else.
Yeah,
no. You meet CK,
he would have hung up on us by now. Yeah,
you're like, here's my next book and my next book. Take them all.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Like, I wrote him a letter, obviously, to thank him for, and I sent it to. It went wherever the things that get sent to Stephen King go. You know, and may not have read it, but I thought it was. It was very sort of dorky, heartfelt letter saying. Know all the things that you would imagine.
It is cool for as famous as he is, he does seem very down to earth and very supportive of other authors.
Yeah.
Oh, I think so. Yeah. No, he's not the problem. I'm the big geek, like who would make it awkward.
And those blurbs will last you a lifetime. Like even if he doesn't read your next 10 books, you can still put it on there, you know, and sell an extra 5,000 copies or whatever they do for you. So.
Yeah, and it's something that I will always have. Just personally, always take it with you, which is lovely.
And I don't want to give Stephen King all the credit, but what do you think it was? Because before Last House came out, I was unfamiliar with your work. I hadn't heard of you as an author before, and then that came out.
And everyone else in the world, yeah.
But I feel like everyone was talking about you, and that book in particular just is like exploded. What do you think it was? I mean, besides the Stephen King blur, but you know, I don't want. Give you your credit because you wrote the book. It's your story. Right. What do you think it was about that book that just exploded and just kind of went viral almost in a way?
I think, well, it did. And I think there was something at work in me when I wrote it in that because I spoke a little bit about the hitherto unpopularity of Little Eve. And I just remember thinking for my next book, I may not, you know, it may not sell because I've done really badly. And you sort of go to book jail after that, you know, and you have like a bad credit rating. No one will give you a publishing deal.
No one's giving you a loan.
No one's giving me a loan, exactly. So, which is kind of what an advance is, really. So I remember thinking, I may not get to do this again. If I never get to do this again, this is my favorite thing and the thing I've dreamed of doing for so long. I'm going to write my big new book, you know. I'm going to write the book that... the book that doesn't conform to rules, the big, ambitious, insane book. And I think it helps not to have anything to lose. And it's something I've tried to take into my writing subsequently, is write like you've got nothing to lose. Because Needless Street, quickly for those who don't know, is about Ted, Lauren and Olivia, who live in a boarded up house at the end of Needless Street, which is ends in this great wild Pacific Northwest forest in Washington State, and children have been going missing in that area for some years. And this woman, Dee, comes to believe that Ted is responsible for those disappearances, so she starts surveillance on him. And she comes to think that maybe his daughter might not actually be his daughter, perhaps it's it might be that he's kidnapped her sister. Right. But part of it is narrated by a little black talking cat.
Yeah.
And this is always the litmus test for this book, is if you can get past the talking cat in chapter two, this might be the book for you. It's it is an incredibly complicated, ambitious book. Like, and I felt, because everything is very much not as it seems, I'm not a big fan of the word twist, because I think twist implies something you're, some kind of trick you're playing on the reader, and I don't like to do that. I prefer reveal, because what I wanted to do was build a world, construct a world so carefully, and then with just the pull of one, you know, what, like the tug of a string or a thread, it would all rearrange itself and become a completely different world, and you'll see, it should make sense, this revelation. So it was the hardest thing I've ever done, I think. I remember getting up in the morning and thinking, I don't know if I can write this today. Like, it's too hard. But again, surely that must be a sign you're doing it right. It was very ambitious, and I don't think there was anything quite like it on, I don't think there's anything quite like it. So I think that helped. And maybe, and also this, the, a lot of, we used to have rejection Mondays. So when we were trying to sell it, it did not fly out of my agent's hands. Believe me, not at all. It took a long time to get, and also almost everybody in publishing rejected it. But the reassuring thing was, everybody hated something different about it. So, okay. Which is great.
We just hate all of it. Everybody's together. Yeah, hate
you're just offending a lot of people all at once with different things. Great.
Well, no, but that's much better, because if everyone hates the same thing or the premise, then maybe it's just not right. But if everyone's picking up on something different, it means it's making them uneasy. You're kind of doing your job, but there's no like one consistent flaw. So that was almost reassuring, actually. And then we had a few publishers who were really bold and were interested, and I finally ended up with Lovely Viper in the UK. So and then subsequently the tour, and I think that they deserve a lot of credit for being like, okay, so there's a talking cat, and going ahead and seeing what it could do, because they, you know, they bought it, both publishers bought it before Stephen King loved it, so it, you know, they really were, I think, and they're both brand new imprints as well, which is kind of wonderful, really. Like, everyone's head is on the block together.
So I was going to ask, but since you don't like the word twist, let me rephrase this. With so many reveals in this book, did you ever confuse yourself or get confused when writing it where you were at the time?
All the time, yeah. and also, I had the structure is so complicated that you, anything you change automatically means almost the whole structure shivers, and you have to change other things as well. So keeping track of all the interconnected sort of gossamer threads which bind it together was really difficult. And I tried to do that thing, you know, that you see writers do in movies where they like make a diagram.
I was gonna say, I could see you with all the connected dots and postcards and stuff.
It did not work. Like, I don't know why, but the moment I did that, it all just died for me. I couldn't see it anymore. The only way that I could write it was to hold it all in my head, which is a terrible, terribly labor-intensive way to do it, but it was the only thing that worked. So I would just quite often just sit there frightened in front of it, just staring at it going, where are we?
Did you not like take notes that you could reference back to? Like, I did this in chapter 2, now I'm in chapter 11, or was it just literally all in your head?
The thing is, if you do that, the note-taking becomes almost as laborious as writing an entire other book, because it was really complicated, and it tested me more emotionally as well. Technically, but also emotionally, like it's a rough book. It goes to some quite dark places, I think.
Mm-hmm. And I can imagine if you were to use like the diagram, like you see in movies, writers. If I could imagine that could handcuff you too, and paint yourself into a corner. Like, well, now I got to change the whole thing, you know, and fix chapter one to equal chapter 11. And so yeah.
I mean, yeah, it for some reason, it wouldn't square with my, with my like imaginative landscape. It just wouldn't do it. It's sort of, these days I try and see it sort of a bit more like a map. So I'm inside, I'm in the map and I know where I'm going. I don't know how I'm going to get there. And you see the book visually in your mind, but for some reason, making that exterior and drawing it or rendering it physically outside, it doesn't work for me. I don't know why. Everyone's different, aren't they?
That just gives me so much more appreciation. Like, I already loved that book, but now I'm so much more appreciative of it that you just had it all in your head and didn't have, like, notes and the board and everything behind you. Because I remember reading it, and there was one scene, it was like, in one scene, like, the carpet was red, or the carpet was blue, and later on it was orange. Just like, she messed up? Did I catch a mistake? And then later on, it's like, oh, it makes so much sense now.
I know, it looks initially like it's just been really badly written or edited.
Because I went back and was like, hey, hold on, before this carpet was blue, now it's orange. Something's not right here.
Yeah, exactly. Is it just sloppy? Am I just sloppy? That level of complexity, this is very much in my brain right now, because I'm just finishing up my next book, Looking Glass Sound, which is it's a big one. It's like Needless Street. It's got a lot, I think it might even be more ambitious if possible. I don't even know how that's possible, but it's very, very different from the others. It's actually, well, I think they're all different. I think so. Like, so I went from Needless Street to Sundial, which is like set in the Mojave Desert, and it's all about like mothers and sisters. And there we go. Oh, isn't she beautiful?
I love this. I love the pink and the purples and stuff. It looks so good.
It's an artist called Corey Brickley, who's just amazing.
That's great.
He's so good. They're so good. I always try and, because I think there's a problem with writing sometimes, whereby when I start to write the next book, I just end up writing more of the last one, but with different character names, because it's difficult to make that transition, isn't it? So I always try and do something really definitively different each time. So where Needless Street was all about isolation and being boarded up, and about a little found family. Sundial is about mothers and daughters and sisters, and the complexity of those relationships. Because I think it's easy to sentimentalize women's relationships on the page and on screen. I think in fiction it's easy to make them cute or pretty, and they're very powerful and very feral. Right. So Callie and Rob, who are the two main characters, the mother and daughter, 13-year-old girl and her mother, go to this facility, I guess it is, in the Mojave Desert, and they face off about the past and the present. And at most of the book, each thinks independently that the other one wants to kill her. And I just find this so relatable for family.
You have some dark secrets to talk about.
Secrets will come out now. We're going to find this is like autobiography later on in life.
Oh, goodness, no. I'm constantly having to reassure my family that they are not in the books. but I just, yeah. You know, horror is just, all it is what you love turning to fear, isn't it? So yeah. I rely on my family so heavily emotionally, and I love them so much. So the flip side of that emotion is being afraid that that's something which nourishes you so deeply could turn to danger. I also think that's a testament to the power and love that exists, because it wouldn't be so frightening if there wasn't so much love, you know?
Yeah, you wouldn't care as much.
Yeah, you wouldn't care. Why would you care? You'd just be like, it would just be sort of scattergun aggression.
So I haven't read, I have not read Sundial yet, but I've had friends tell me it is also not twisty, but mind-bendery, or, you know, has the reveal. Yeah. And Little Eve has that as well, you know, the reveals and stuff. So I feel like that's sort of kind of your style now with Last House. Is The Girl from Wildblood, is that like that as well, or is that different?
That actually does have a reveal as well, yeah. I mean, okay. I think it's sort of, the reveal kind of, for me, feels very like life. Because there is no omniscient narrator, you know, whispering in our ear, telling us what's important or what, you know, what's going to happen. And, you know, that feeling that being completely blindsided and yet in retrospect looking back and seeing how all the signs were there, I find that incredibly realistic. And I think it reproduces, in a way, it sort of dismantles what we go to books for, because we go to books for them to be better than life, don't we? We want them to be more organized, have like character consistency and arcs and beginnings and endings and villains and victims and heroes. You really use any of that stuff. I make it much more walking into the darkness, as I feel we do day to day. You know, it's walking, feeling your way blind and hoping there's light at the end. God, I'm making these sound fun, aren't I?
But... Well, the horror readers are like, yes, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, I mean, that's what we're looking for. Yeah.
Like when you start a new book, do you go into it saying, well, what kind of reveal can I do? Or is it just something that naturally progresses as you're going along with the rest of the story anyway?
Well, I always have the beginning and the end. Often they change, but I start mm-hmm. with the beginning and the end. And I always want to know, like, what's the point of this book? Because each reveal should tell you something, not just about the book, but about, like, you, about your life, about life, about some truth, you know, that perhaps you can come away with and ponder. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of the starting point, is what dreadful surprise, shock, or revelation would make you see the world differently, you know. Mm-hmm. And then you try and render it in book form. So that's kind of what my starting point. And I often, as I said, in the map, I don't know how I'm going to get from beginning to end, but I do uh-huh. know those two fixed points. You've got sort of tentpole moments that you know you have to reach. And yeah. I mean, plot is your best friend in that respect, because it's just with so much unknown and with quite often keeping so much from the reader, it can feel like you're inside a mad person's brain, which actually technically I suppose I am inside this brain, which is pretty mad. But so plot and sticking to structure become really important. I think each book should be more challenging than the last, if possible, and hopefully the last thing you've done is your best thing. That's the hope. So I uh-huh. always try and push the envelope further and further each time.
Do you ever take a break in between books? Because you had mentioned that sometimes you start mm-hmm. the next one and it's like a continuation of the last one. Any kind of break in between so you don't make it exactly like it, or do you go straight for it?
I mean, I'm lucky enough to be doing one a year at the moment, so no, there is no break. No break. And that's been an adjustment as well, because I used to have a little bit of time to decompress and stuff, and now I'm, because, but it's a privilege to be allowed to do one a year. Right. It's a privilege to be asked. So mm-hmm. I've had to learn how to, you know, shed my skin a bit quicker. It's all a learning process. That's the thing, is you never stop learning. When I finished my first novel, I was like, brilliant, I know how to write now. It's great, I can do it.
I'm a superstar, I'm good.
I know how to do it because I learned how to do it and then I did it.
Yeah.
No, 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 no. Each book is a different world, and you fail and learn an equal amount, I would say, on each one. You just learn to do it quicker.
Mm-hmm. James has a question real quick. If you could sort of recommend a book of yours to start, where would you say? I'd recommend Last House on Needle Street, personally.
Yeah, I think Last House is a good place to start. I think it's my breakthrough book, and it's certainly, I think, my most popular to date, and mm-hmm. Put it this way: if you can go that far into the crazy, then you'll be able to handle whatever else is in the other.
Whatever else is there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was you that said it or if it was the Tor Twitter account, but Mindbenders. I like that description for your books.
Yeah.
Instead of twisty and stuff, Mindbenders.
Yeah. Mindbenders. Yeah, exactly. I think, yeah, I suppose, it just reflects that sort of constant hypervigilant surprise I feel at being alive every day. You know, being alive is kind of a mind-bending exercise in itself, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
What has changed over the years, the books? Because you said all of your books have a lot of these reveals in it and take you on these journeys and all. Anything like particularly it's changed your style of writing, your process of doing so?
I think my first two books were much more traditional gothic. So they were historical. They were set in the UK. They right. were, distressed girls wandering about on moors, which is a genre I have a huge amount of time for. I love. But, I did it twice with The Girl from Warblood and then Little Eve. And although I'm very proud of those books, I just thought, you know, it was part of that sort of sea change moment where I thought, I'd like to do something really different. And mm-hmm. as we were discussing before we came on, despite talking like Masterpiece Theatre, I am actually American. And I grew up here. I grew up here. And I thought I'd really like to use that part of myself as a writer. I'd like to use the landscape. I'd like to use, you know, the things I remember and the smells and the sights and the sounds of like these neighborhoods I grew up in and these amazing canvases like the Mojave Desert. I really wanted to pivot to that. So I thought, what would be great? was to bring all of those wonderful Gothic preoccupations that genre has, like, right. you know, it's like all of that structural stuff it contains, and transpose it into these sort of slightly suburban or, you know, very quintessentially American landscapes, and uh-huh. also, you know, and to write them in idiomatically in this very, very close first person. My aim is always that you're wearing the characters like a skin, you know, proper horror image. So you're not really, it should be an uncomfortable level of proximity. It should be an uncomfortable intimacy. You're looking through their eyes, and it's not always a comfortable experience. So those are probably the two things which I made a big shift in for Needless Street and continued to use. But then it still has this, like, because it still has this continuity with my past work. But, you know, Gothic is by its nature deeply fragmented. It's a series of testimonies and accounts which are put uh-huh. together to make the story, like Dracula, Jonathan Harker's journal. And I feel like these, you know, the way that the narratives, when they puzzle piece together, tell the story, is inherently very Gothic as well. Yeah. So, you know, I feel like I'm still in the process of becoming, I suppose, as we all are, but. Mm-hmm. I was so excited when I suddenly just threw off the more traditional trappings of that northern historical Gothic.
You right. know? Do you feel it's more freeing to do it sort of the way you're doing it, as opposed to sort of sticking to this sort of structure and fitting your style and more in storytelling?
Yeah. Into a hot... Yeah, for me, yeah. But then I've done it twice, uh-huh. so that would make sense. So maybe I couldn't have done it if I hadn't practiced and got really embedded myself in those more traditional, you know, Gothic settings in a more traditional time period. I don't know. And I also love. I don't. You know, I will never stop reading all forms of Gothic novels, you know, contemporary or otherwise. So it's not a. I just want to be clear. I'm not like dissing Gothic novels because I love them.
Right. But I mean, go ahead.
I was going to say, maybe it's time to accept the fact that your style is not to have a certain style, to be untraditional way of things. That's just your style. So maybe.
Well, I can accept that. There you go. I mean, that sounds great. That sounds what a wonderful kind of amazing creative place to be, I guess. You yeah. know?
And I might be wrong, and this might be awkward if the answer is no, but don't you teach like a Gothic kind of class or something every so often?
I did. Okay. I used to teach, I haven't done it this year. I need to write books, but hopefully in the future I can go back to it. I'm also working on bringing both Needless Street and Sundial to film, which I can't really talk about. But yeah, I mean, you can have, how does one do that with Needless Street?
Just thinking about Needless Street, like how to adapt that to film where it doesn't give everything away. Because it's different when it's on page, because you can only see what the characters are seeing. So that'd be really interesting to see it on film.
who's going to play the cat?
Yeah. You got to get the cat from Sabrina the Teenage Witch. Just bring it back. Bring it back.
There we go.
I feel like Meryl Streep would make an amazing cat.
She would. That should be a good Olivia.
She'd be incredible. But yeah, so I the time has been a little bit more limited mm-hmm. this year. So I haven't done it this year, but I really hope to go back to it in the future. It's the Arvon course, which is in the UK. I teach it with Natasha Pulley. And it's a week-long residential course. And everybody goes and stays in these amazing, beautiful old sort of they've got three sites around the country. Everyone goes and mm-hmm. stays together for the week, and you workshop, you read and workshop stuff, and you know, we give seminars in the morning. It's really fun, and I learn a lot too. You know, I learn a lot from doing it and from the people who take part.
It sounds immersive getting to go to those different locations and sort of be immersed in that setting and stuff too. I feel like that would help out your imagination and your writing and stuff, being in those settings.
Oh, it's great. It's really great. And also, like, we almost always do it over the Halloween week, which was
so that's even
now.
Better.
Yeah.
And one year, someone like, people got lost, a mist descended, phones cut out. There, someone threw a skinned sheep over the wall. We found it in the early morning mist. I mean, it was as if someone was writing us.
Oh, say, it sounds like someone's writing the book for you right there.
Yeah. Well, we wondered whether we were in a book, you know.
I mean, did people think there were props that you were doing on purpose, or just taking it in, you know?
Yeah, I wish I'd been the mastermind behind it, but no, it was just a really freaky weekend.
The skinless, the skinned sheep. They threw it over the wall. So
yes, it was a skinned. It was. Yeah, it was flayed. So.
Did y'all call like the cops or something? Or.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, and you know, it was really amazing. And like someone had been some
horror writer. It's really amazing.
yeah. Exactly. Loved it. Great. Took notes. But someone had been in the pub the night before, the local pub, which is 2 miles walk along a misty country lane. Uh-huh. And you know, that someone said something menacing to them about, oh, you see what you find in the morning, my lover. And and I mean it was definitely a harbinger moment, like an the opening. anyway.
The horse headed to bed.
Yeah, yeah. I mean even that's much more rational, isn't it? It's
yeah. Kind of more of a mob style. So
right? Exactly.
Hamlin Bird has a question. How long do you typically spend writing a new project?
I used to spend my first novel took me 7 years, or maybe closer to 8 actually, and my second novel took me 2 years, and then Needless Street took me 1, and ever since then it's been a sort of 8-month cycle. That's for readable first draft, you know. I think that you know that there will probably be ones that take longer in the future, because books are also different. They all have their own
right.
natures and characteristics, and it's always very difficult to predict what they're going to need. But because I'm now, my resolution was, as long as I can bear it, I'll do one a year, because it's you know, it's as I said, it's an honor to be asked, so I will try and continue to do that. And that, so an eight months from start to readable manuscript, I think, is there, and then you have editing and stuff.
Do you just work on one at a time, or?
Oh God, yeah. Well, I mean, it depends what you mean. It depends what you mean by working on. So, you know, I do, like, I'm right this morning. I was up at 5 writing Looking Glass Sound, and now I'm on here talking about Little Eve. You know, it's you know, if you're always, you've always got a bit of cross pollination in terms right. of and also you'll be editing one while trying to start the next.
Okay.
But I think in terms of getting that first draft out, I don't think some people do. I couldn't work on two at once.
And with your first book, The Girl from Rawblood, did you have a full-time job while you were writing that?
Yes, so that probably... which may have been why it took so long.
Yeah.
Yeah. I worked for a human rights foundation in London. And it did take a long time because of that, but I think it also took a long time because I was teaching myself how to write.
Yeah.
You know, it's
trial and error. And
so much error. Yeah.
Yeah. So is there anything like in your past, like you may have written when you were younger, that we might see in the future that you might just unravel and just blow off to dust and release?
No, I mean, I don't. The thing is that there's only one thing that I started writing a couple of years ago, and then I decided to write Sundial instead. But which I'm trying to get my publishers to bite on. It's quite. Once again, it's a complete departure. It's completely different from anything I've ever done. It's vampires. Like I just don't know if
just give it to me. No, vampires. Yeah. I'm a sucker for vampires.
I think.
And then if you write vampires, I'm like for real a sucker for it.
Oh, I'll find a way to make them depressing. Don't worry.
No, it's okay.
It's really exciting. I won't talk too much about it because I don't know if I'm going to go for it. And I'll be sad. But that's the only thing that in my sort of bottom drawer. Project, because I'm not very prolific. I only have about 4 ideas, you know. I've only had about 4 ideas in my life, and I wrote them all. And so they tend to arrive. Good ideas tend to arrive very, very slowly. I did have an idea that I chucked actually, which was about a group of psychics who went around recreating murders, like staging murders, as performances. At the murder scenes, in order to summon the ghosts of the murdered. It was just even for me, it was just too weird. I couldn't get on with it.
That caught my attention just a little bit just now.
Well, I mean, I may revisit it. I may revisit it, but I mean, I may have to, because as I said, I don't have many ideas. I tend to just write the ones.
Well, and
I
one
have,
of the characters so... could be me, and you
kill that character. There you go. Oh, and... Perfect. We can go to your to the scene of your death and summon you.
And then Stephen King will read it and blurb it. And then that's He'll my connect. It. Six degrees of separation. There See, you have it all set up now.
Oh my God. I don't know if I can ever expect that magic to happen to me again. But you know, I've had a good run, isn't it? I can just
die. I can be done.
And I'm done. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Paul Shepard has a question. Sort of going along with, you don't have very many ideas. Would you ever think about revisiting one of your books for a sequel or prequel? If that would even be possible, depending on how they end.
Well, yeah, many of my characters start the book dead. So yes, it's very difficult. But I did have a strange experience with Sundial the other day when I had to, for various reasons, imagine what a sequel would be like, not in book form, but in another medium. And I found it very exciting. Actually, I really enjoyed it, and I thought, God, I might like to dive into this. I don't think there's a follow up to Needless Street. I think Needless Street is complete world unto itself. But I could, I wouldn't rule it out. You know, it would be really fun to, it'd be really fun to see where those characters go with, you know, as I said, because you know, every book you're a different person. You know, on a molecular level almost. I'd be really interested to try it as an experiment, but I think I want to do the new ideas first.
Right.
Uh-huh. See if I can get my publishers to bite on the vampires.
Well, everyone's loving the vampire idea. So
yeah,
if Tor Nightfire or whoever else is listening, which probably not, but if they are, give her the contract.
I mean, we can send this video to whoever you want.
Just that one little snippet. Write it. Give her the vampire novel.
And as far as Meryl Streep being the cat in the Needless Street movie, we'll just go on Twitter and just start. Starting that process.
That immediately go to her home, just you know.
Just pick it outside her fence.
Don't do that, everyone. You know. Not that I have that kind of power, but just in case it wasn't clear.
So with I really want to say something about Last House, and then we'll move on to Little Eve since that's your new one. But I've read some reviews where, and I don't know if you pay attention to reviews, if you read them, don't care about them, if they bother you at all, but some of them were. And I want to try not to spoil the book, but there's a certain condition in the book, and some of the reviews were saying that you were sort of villainizing the condition or sort of taking advantage of it, which was very obvious that they didn't finish the book because that's not what you were doing at all. So did you see reviews like that? If so, do they bother you? Do you just try to ignore them or?
Well, I obviously want to be, you know, my intention is. You know, to do a sensitive examination of something which is an extraordinary condition and an extraordinary thing that the mind is capable of, to you know, a self-protection mechanism. I will always listen if people say that I've got something wrong. I did a lot of research before I started, but you know, I'm human. I spoke to as many people as I could about their experiences with this everything I heard actually taught me that I wasn't going far enough with with how extraordinary this condition is. So, and I sent the book to the people concerned after it was done and made sure that they knew it was coming out and asked them, you know, gave them the option should they wish to review it. And you know. I also I've never had any people obviously feel strongly about this issue, and it's not my place to tell them how to feel.
Right.
And some of them may have been absolutely affected by this in their lives. I've yet to, as far as I can tell from the people with this condition themselves, nobody with the condition seems to have told me that seems to have had a problem with it. I'm always listening. Of course I am. I don't necessarily listen via the medium of Goodreads, you know, but I think, you know, that way madness lies. I'm not going to try and pay attention like that. But people write to me, people tell me things. And there's been a couple of people with this particular condition that who have written to me and said that they found it rather empowering, and that to see themselves at the center of a story, and to see this discussed in a sort of human way as opposed to used as a plot device. I never want to make the last thing I want to do is to exploit or victimize anyone. The only thing I want to do is tell the story, which I hope illuminates how extraordinary these, you know, survival and human you know, determination to endure can be. So that, I mean, of course, it's, you know, I'm it's not own voices. I'm not someone who suffers with that. But
yeah,
I think I hope I told a human story with compassion. That's all I can do, you know.
Yeah, and just, I love your author's note in that book, because it really felt like you, just from that, you took a lot of time and research and care into portraying that in the story. You weren't just slapping something up with that just for the sake of doing it, for like a shock factor or anything.
No.
Like, you really cared about what you were putting on the page, and you didn't want to, you wanted to portray it as, what's the word I'm looking for, as authentic as possible.
I did try, yeah. And I think it should, you know, that there's certainly a little, a slightly unkind trick, not trick, but an unkind tactic the book employs, which is it perhaps slightly lures the reader into leaning into their preconceptions about mental health for a uh-huh. little time before it corrects. And I think that was important too, because, you know, we've all got, I think there can be a problem in horror, actually, mm-hmm. as much as I love it and I'm a champion for it. It can be a real problem in horror in depicting mental health in a sensitive and fully vibrant and real way.
Right.
So mm-hmm. That's what I wanted to do. I really hope it worked. And my aim is always to lift up, not to denigrate or diminish.
Yeah, because when the book first starts out, it seems like very obvious what's going on. Like this is the yes. reveal, and it becomes something much more than what it actually is.
Before a lot of the reveals, not twists. Yes. I'm going to start reveals. Using reveals myself. In all of my reviews, I'm going to say this book had a lot of reveals. From now on.
I'm sorry, I don't. I'm not. You do you. You know, it's.
No, I like it because you know, I'm always looking for, like, when I do my reviews, I'm looking for a word that's different than what I want to see.
right.
A different word than what's overused, and sometimes you mm-hmm. can't. But I like reveals. I'm gonna go with that. So
I mean, and I feel like it's because you've done it great. I feel like it's hard to pull that off because sometimes, like you said, you can look back and sort of reflect. Okay, it makes sense now that I've at the end. I know what has happened. It's not just like, oh, well, aliens were responsible. It's just like, where did that come from? That makes,
yeah.
That like yeah. makes no
and
sense.
And they were all,
like,
really dead. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. It's not like just completely out of left field where it's like, you're just dumbfounded by, like, oh, wow. That's the kind of twist that, like, is horrible. Just something that doesn't make any sense. But yours all makes sense, especially when you look back. It's like, okay, now I can see the little baby steps and crumbs and why the carpet right. was orange and why it was blue. And, you know, it all makes sense now at the end. Is that hard for you to pull that?
Just I don't know if you've ever seen Brad's video review he did, but he was like, I want to tell you guys so much, but I can't. And he was just flipping out about it. And like, he's talking for like 7 minutes. And he's like, but he doesn't tell us anything about it. He just said, I can't tell you, but trust me, Andrew's a talking cat. And he just keeps going on and on about it.
I was like, 30 seconds ago, I was like, stop watching my video, go read the book, and then come back.
That was part of, in fact, the initial marketing campaign was like, what can we tell you?
Yeah.
Exactly. It was very, very, it was very interesting. And so what they did was they sort of just lent into the problem and went, we can't tell you anything about this book, which is quite a marketing strategy, actually.
It is. Because it's like, well, why can't you? Why can't you? And then you get people curious about it.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure it would. It was quite bold though. I'm not sure it would work for all books, but yeah, it was. They were great.
I was maybe, I don't know, 3/4 of the way through. I was like, okay, I think I know what's going on now. I'm fully into it. I've got everything figured out. And then you hit this another reveal. It was like literally my jaw dropped because I did not see it coming whatsoever. It was like, I can't tell anybody about this because it's so good. I don't want to spoil it for anybody. I don't want to ruin the experience.
Oh, that's so good. I mean, what was really amazing is how good people were at keeping the secret. Like, mm-hmm. I was really impressed because it came out in the States, I think, a good 6 months after it came out in the UK. And readers became very protective of it. They became very, like, vigilant about guarding it for friends and for the general public. Like, people were really, they were really great about it. I was really impressed and quite a little bit moved by their determination not to ruin the story for other people. It was incredibly it was incredibly like unexpected, because of course you think if a book's been out for 6 months, everyone's going to just Google it, you know, just Google plot summary from The Last House on Needless Street. And but it was it remained surprisingly intact, which I was, you know, just goes to show that horror readers remain the best, and horror people in general.
Like my wife listened to it on audiobook, but before she started, she doesn't read very much, but she was like, what's it about? I was like, I can't tell you. Just, you got to read it. And then at the end,
read it.
You can't, I can't tell you anything about it.
And then like Brad was saying earlier, some of the negative reviews, you know, you could tell they either didn't finish it or they just didn't get it.
Yeah.
You know, they just didn't get it, understand it, take it in what was happening. So.
Yeah. And it's not, you know, maybe some people don't want to necessarily spend their time in such a dark place, you know, maybe they need escapism from books, you know, it may not be for everyone, you know, everyone should read what they want to read.
Yeah. And people are entitled to their opinions and everything like that. I'm not saying that, but it just, those particular negative ones just drove me nuts. Like, you finish the book and you'll see that maybe it's not actually what it seems.
Yeah. I mean, in a way, it's you know, like the Rejection Mondays. There's something quite reassuring about it. You can tell they just haven't finished the book, because it's like, oh, well, okay, well, it's because you haven't finished the book, you know.
Uh-huh.
And I used to keep tabs on, sort of like Goodreads reviews, and, you know, read through them. And now I think I've reached the stage where I just can't do that anymore. I feel like because I'm so busy with the next book, each time I release a book, you get to this sort of stage of like, you develop a kind of like a moment of parting, you know, you just hand it over to the world and that's it. And that's its fate. Yeah. And I'm always very, very interested in, you know, interesting to hear what readers think. But I think, you know, like reading online reviews and things like that it can really drag you back into a strange state of mind where you're sort of worrying about something you wrote almost 2 years ago. And I think always onwards and upwards, you know.
I can see that be a snowball effect, like you're second guessing yourself about it, and then it just snowballs.
And there's nothing to be done. It's published, it's out there, you've finished it.
You've, in fact, got your kid out there. They need to sink or swim.
It's got to sink or swim, you know, baby's girl grows up, so.
So we're getting a lot of comments about Little Eve in the comments here. Should we transition? Lovely. Should we do a read? You want to be reading now and then hop into it? Or how you want to do it?
Yeah, I can do that.
I just like Heidi's comment real quick. The synopsis for Needle Street is just read it. Yeah. that should have been the back cover copy. Just read the book.
Oh, well, that's very kind. So onto Little Eve, which came out last week.
So what is Little Eve about, before you read a little?
Little Eve is about, Little Eve is about a young woman who may or may not have killed her entire family in a snake worshipping cult in the middle of a circle of standing stones on a Scottish island on New Year's Eve, 1920.
So some easy reading for a nice Saturday afternoon. Yeah.
Family friendly.
It's a comedy. It's a comedy.
Yeah. Shakespearean comedy.
What part do you have that you're going to read for us?
I'm going to read the beginning, because I always think, you know, like, I always think, why did I put that at the beginning if I don't want readers to start there?
Yeah.
So, that makes sense.
All right. I'll just do a very short one, because I always think
however long or short as you want. It's cool with us.
Totally fine.
Okay. All right. So, Dinah, 1921. My heart is a dark passage lined with ranks of gleaming jars. In each one, something floats, the past preserved as if in spirit. Here is the scent of grass in the sea. Here, the creak of wheels on a rough path. Here, a bright yellow gull's beak. The sensation of blood drying on my cheek in the wind. Abel crying for his mother. Uncle's hand on me, silver on a white collarbone. The knowledge of loss, which comes like a blow to the heart or the stomach. It does not reach your mind until later. She is there too, of course, Evelyn. Somewhere along the rows, behind glass, she floats in dim air. I do not seek her out. My survival depends on that. After everything and against all odds, I have been given a chance. A life, never mind what kind. I have people who depend on me and I on them. Never mind who they are. I am filled with memory. I must make room in this dark passage. So I cast it forth this day. I give it to you. This is the day I became what I am. On the morning of the 2nd of January, 1921, James McWraith was roused by silence. The storm that had raged across the coast for 3 days had passed. Thunder, thrushes and waxwings sang in the silver birches that lined Loyal's narrow to cobbled streets. It was 6:30, and there would be no dawn in these northern reaches for some hours. Jamie was 28 years of age, in good health, and had never married. He dressed by the light of a candle in front of a small square of glass that hung on the wall above the chest of drawers, a vest, thick woolen socks with gaiters, and the collar of his cotton shirt tied together with a bright red kerchief, sheepskin waistcoat smelling strongly of lanolin. He painstakingly worked up lather from a sliver of shaving soap and stropped his razor, put in his dental plate, filling the dark gap on the left side of his upper jaw with a white incisor and canine. The teeth had been lost in a blast in France. Last of all, he put in on with care the cufflinks his father had left to him. These were battered silver, inlaid with yellowing ivory, and Jamie McWraith had always loved them. When he held them in his hand, he felt the sway of a long trunk, the gentle tread of a great foot on dusty earth. He caught the scent of flowering hibiscus. The cufflinks also made him recall his father's death. The upstairs of the cottage comprised two bedrooms, one occupied by Jamie. The other had been his father's and now lay empty, but sometimes he still heard his father moving about in there. At 7:50, Jamie was unlocking the shop. He had been the butcher in Loyal for 2 years since he came home from the war. He went to the cellar, unhooked a large side of beef and wrapped it up in a sheet. He dragged it out to where Bill, the pony, was tethered in front of the shop. He'd spent several months training him not to fear the scent of blood, but still, Bill sometimes balked at it. The beef had been ordered by the castle of Altnahara for New Year's Eve, known as Hogmanay in these parts. It was now 3 days late owing to the storm, and Jamie was uneasy concerning payment. He loaded the side of beef onto Bill using a harness and clips of his own design, and set off along the path which led along the sea. He did not meet or see a living soul on the road. At 9:00, at the hour of winter sunrise, birds started circling in the brightening sky, and the hills were painted in russet brown and grey, rolling on and on into the deep north. Out to sea, the sun was a burning ball, casting its shattered light on the water. The castle of Altnahara sat on the isle of the same name, a quarter of a mile off the western shore of the peninsula. Colonel John Barings had settled it in 1898 after returning from India. He repaired the castle, planted gardens, set up beehives. Two women joined him, Alice Seddington and Nora Marr. They took in four infants, foundlings plucked from the many destitute communities that litter the highlands. The inhabitants of Altnahara came into the village every now and again to buy bootlaces or to have harness mended. They were considered odd, but were left alone. But after the murder in 1917, a great steel gate appeared across the stone causeway that connected Altnahara to the mainland. The children stopped attending the school in Loyal. The women no longer came to the village for bootlaces, no longer gathered driftwood on the shore. They retreated into themselves. They left polite notes at the gate. Pale green wool, the shade of a cabbage heart, please. Knitting needles, times three. Three sharp flensing knives and a ball of string, large. Beef for Hogmanay, please, hung for at least 3 weeks. The people of Loyal would check the basket as they passed out Altnahara and left the goods when they next happened by. Payment was left in the cage in the same fashion, always correct, to the farthing. It was said by the residents of Altnahara, as said by the villagers in Loyal, that the residents of Altnahara opened the gate at night under the autumn moon and ran wild over the moor, painted blue, looking for souls to take. Some said they were all long dead and the isle was populated by ghosts. But Jamie did not believe any of this. Ghosts and fairies did not use things like lamb's mince or wool. The walkway to the isle lay before him now under an inch of gleaming water. He congratulated himself he had timed his journey so well, for the tide would soon turn and be coming in again. Altnahara could only be reached at the ebb, and if he had dawdled, the sea would have been lapping at his thighs by the time he came to cross. Bill, the pony, balked at the causeway. He planted his 4 feet firmly and showed that he would not get his hooves wet. Jamie tried to persuade him with a piece of sugared bread, which he'd meant for his own lunch. He petted, he threatened, all to no avail. The pony would not go across. Rather than argue with 500 pounds of stubborn Highland, Jamie unhooked the beef, took it onto his own back, and waded precariously out to the isle. He heard the distant bark of seals as he waded, and the stiff wind blew in the wake of the storm. More than once, the weight of the beef nearly toppled him. As Jamie came close, the wind sang strangely through the steel gate. It was 15 feet tall, hung from vast posts. Heavy chains held it fast. Jamie put the beef in the wire cage with a thump, but as he turned to go, he stumbled in the shallow water and steadied himself by grasping a spar of the gate. At his touch, it swung slowly open, and Jamie went with it, falling to his knees with a splash. Before him was a small blue pebble beach, a path that led up the hill through yellowed winter grass. Sheep scratched mournfully at the hard earth, and above, the tumble-down silhouette of the castle was stark against the sky. Jamie straightened and called hello. The sheep leapt away in alarm, but no answer came. "I thought they wished me to bring the meat up to the castle," he told the inquest later, "and that they had left the gate open for me." He shouldered the beef and climbed the narrow stony path, the sky clearing to the sharp blue of a cold day. But beyond, to the west, the land was bathed in light, but to Jamie, each step he took felt like a trespass. The castle was surrounded by a motte, old and crumbling, and the rusting portcullis was half descended. In the courtyard beyond, scraps of white paper or handkerchiefs tossed violently in the wind. The spikes on the portcullis were sharp, and Jamie did not want to put himself under, as it looked as if it might go all the way down at any time and into me. He called out to the house again, and again there was no answer. He rolled the beef under the metal spears, and then reluctantly, with his eyes tightly closed, he wriggled through, waiting for the old iron to hurtle earthwards and pierce his ribs. Once inside the courtyard, he called again. Jamie was really put out by this time. He thought that perhaps he was being mocked, or there was some game being played. And he saw as he approached the kitchen door that the white handkerchiefs were in fact 5 or 6 white gulls scrabbling over scraps of something. As he raised his fist to pound on the oak door, one gull, pursued by its fellows, barreled into his legs and it dropped what it was holding in its beak at Jamie McGraith's feet. This proved to be a human thumb, severed neatly at the joint.
Dun, dun, dun. Nice.
Dun, dun, dun. Exactly.
So as with reading the author's note for Little Eve, this one seems like maybe a more personal book for you since it's set in Scotland, and you said that's where your mother's originally from.
And you just really... by the way, you just sold like 12 in the chat, by the way.
Yeah.
So you
know, reading a little bit. But...
Oh, thank you guys. That's wonderful. Oh yes, exactly. Come adore my unloved baby. I mean, they're all personal, aren't they? They're all extremely. Uh-huh. They all cut you. You tear each one from your chest with a bloody fist.
Mm-hmm.
It's very personal. This one in lots of ways. So my first novel used as a landscape, the landscape of Dartmoor, which is where we used to spend all of our summers when we were moving around. I grew up in the US, Yemen, Madagascar, Kenya, Morocco, and we always went back to Dartmoor, which. It's sort of quite like Scotland, actually. It's very moors and standing stones and wild ponies, and it's lovely. But for Little Eve, I wanted to use Scotland particularly because it's where my mother was born. And she moved to Zimbabwe when she was with her family, not on her own. when she was three, with her brothers and sister, and. It's got this amazing hold on them. She was born in Ayr, which is the birthplace of the great Scottish poet Robbie Burns.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever you get them all together, they still, especially when they had a wee dram in them, a wee dram of whiskey, they still speak in this incredibly rich Scottish accent. And it moved me so much. I think it's so interesting that this remains so deep in them, this place, so deeply embedded. Despite how long they've been gone and you know, being raised in very, very, very different climate and environment and country. So I wanted to use that. And as well, because there's this simultaneous longing for home and also sense of being a stranger, always a stranger in a strange land, whether they're in Zimbabwe or in Scotland. And that's sort of a lot of what Little Eve is about. Oh, and it's obviously a lot about murder as well. But
oh yeah,
lots of murder.
Yeah.
So, like going into this one, like starting out, I didn't expect it to be the mindbender reveal-y one like Last House it is, but it ends up sort of being the same way, not to necessarily the same extent, but still on that same level, which I wasn't expecting going in. But I really liked. I don't. Maybe I should have expected it. I don't know. After reading Last House, but I really liked. that's very much sort of a slow burn with the sort of reveals and stuff. And it's not till later on in the book that all that starts to kind of unravel.
Yeah. It's got, yes. So Eve is, the book is sort of told from two different viewpoints. There's Dinah who survives and Eve who is the murderer who then disappears. And you learn about what the days and years leading up to the murder from Eve. You learn about the cult and this, you know, the snake rituals, and about Uncle, who is the lead, who's their, you know, patriarch. And then you learn about the subsequent investigation after the murders and Dinah's survival and her, you know, her trying to rationalize her trauma in the other part of the book. And they sort of meet in the middle at the murders. Eve is told that she can read minds, which I always think is a very interesting thing that, you know, happens with cults, is this simultaneous control, but also sense of grandiosity that people are given. You know, everybody is vying for or being made to feel special. But for Eve, obviously, it's real. And a lot of the book is a dialogue between about whether what exactly her gift is, if it's anything, superstition and faith, because I don't think superstition and faith are the same thing. It's a lot about control, the things that preoccupy me greatly, you know, about control, about death and fear thereof. Determining your destiny in a chaotic world, because a lot of it takes place during World War I as well.
Yeah.
So this is this time of great change. I mean, also what a time for horror, real world horror right there.
I thought it was interesting that it takes place, you know, a lot of 1920s and then up to the 1930s by the end. But when they're on the aisle, in the castle, it feels much later in time, like maybe the 1800s or something, because there's no technology.
They're sort of
isolated and they just have like clothes on. It feels like almost two different time frames almost at the same time. Was that something that was sort of maybe intentional, or just something that just kind of happened along the way with it, maybe where it felt older than it actually was set?
I think that's all part of the deprivation that's imposed on them, you know. They refuse, as is quite typical, as I understand it, with cults. They refuse to participate in any way with the outside world. They're hermetically sealed, as it were. So, you know, and keeping people away from forms of communication and technology is very much a part of that.
You didn't have to join a cult for research on this, did you?
She started her own.
No, yeah, exactly.
That's what that sheep, the skin sheep, was over the wall. That was the start of the cult.
Well, I was just thinking, instead of doing the, like, she doesn't like to do the diagrams to set up everything. It's just all in her head. I figure the research, she had to join one.
To paraphrase, if you can't find one, start one.
Start one.
Oh, no, it's lovely. Well, thank you. Lovely to discuss that book.
Did you do any research on like cult mentality or psychology or anything for this one specifically?
I mean, a lot of it's just my natural leisure reading anyway, to be honest. But I did a lot of research on Scottish folk tales and on telepathy and mind reading and cold reading, and that was very, very interesting. The different ways that one can persuade one. I mean, I think this occurs in Needle Street as well, is, you know, the different ways the mind finds to persuade, to circle around unpalatable truths, you know. I do a lot of research, and I listen to my mother, just like, you know, that longing in her voice. It's very, something about it which really helps me click back into the book whenever I needed to get back into it, you know.
Has your mom read the book? Did she read it when it came out?
Yeah, she did, thank goodness. And she's also read her new the new foreword, which sort of talks, is a little bit more explicit about all of that, and luckily she wasn't too horrified, so that's good.
I was saying, did she like it, or did she say, no, you messed this up, this part's not right, or
Thank God. Also, like, you don't live there, you don't know. but no, she's lovely. She's very supportive, actually, and she was rather moved by seeing, I don't know, having me write about something that was so inspired by her life. You know, mm-hmm. she found that quite lovely, and you know, a way of kind of commemorating something.
Is that someone your mother? Is that someone you run stuff by from time to time for your books, or just wait for the?
No. I think you always got to write like no one's watching, but also definitely don't write like your parents aren't.
Yeah, make sure mom's not watching. Just, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Like, just don't read chapter 7, 9, 15, 29. Just have a list of what they can't read. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that would actually be quite handy.
Just give them the redacted part. It's all blacked out, like CIA documents or something.
Right.
But you said earlier in the show that you know, your newest work is your best work. So did you have any? And I don't want this to sound negative. I'm not trying to meet it in a negative way. But did you have any fear or trepidation releasing an older book after you've put out Last House and Sundial? Like, maybe people wouldn't think it was up to par as your last two books, since you wrote it before or anything like that, or maybe, did you just not think about it? Or
thing is, I mean, because the good thing about that book is it was so unsuccessful that it couldn't possibly do worse. I just felt like Tor wouldn't, Nightfire wouldn't have taken it on if they thought it wasn't going to work. Obviously, it's different, and it's strange to have something which I've moved on from as a writer, you know, out in the world. But it is nice, it's a redemption arc for the book itself, you know. So I love it. I didn't worry too much about it, as I said, because it could only have gone upwards, really.
It's like, you know, like we said earlier, put your kid out there, and what happens happens with it. So.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's right.
So with the with this one, the character of Uncle was very interesting. And was he ever named at all throughout the book, or did they just call him Uncle the whole time? Did he mention his name at all?
John. He's called John.
I think Officer Black knows his name, right?
Yeah, he does. He's John Baring, I think.
That's right.
Yes, John Baring. Sorry, he's sort of. You know, he's
a very creepy guy, but he's like not creepy almost at the same time. He's a very odd character.
Yeah. Well, you see him through the eyes of Eve and Dinah. So, you know, to them, he's sort of godlike. And mm-hmm. then I think, you know, and it's not too much of a spoiler because it happens very early on in the book, but you know, he's one of the murdered in the circle. And, mm-hmm. And there's a moment where someone, Dinah who survives, sort of thinks, well, he's actually quite small, isn't he? She never realized that when he was alive.
Like, the veil's been pulled back.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And also with this, the snake cult, was that something that you drew upon some folklore or anything, or did you just make that whole thing up?
Oh, that I made up, yeah. Completely. All from my imagination, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know if it was something you drew from Scottish folklore or anything, or that was just strictly
thing. I think you know, the handling of the snakes was very, you know, it was almost from those rattlesnake churches. because
they're nice snakes, Jay. They're nice snakes.
Yeah.
That's one of my like Brad's main thing is eyeball horror.
Yeah, I can't do like, the eyeball horror. And there's eyeball horror in this too. It's awful.
Oh yeah. I'm not there a fan is. Sorry about
that.
Stuff,
so, yeah. Then again, this goes back to being uncomfortable, you know, so.
Oh, you said you're blind in that one, in that eye?
I'm actually blind in this eye. So I think I didn't really think about it. And then someone pointed out afterwards, they were like, oh, you're talking about someone who, you know, like ends up being blind in one eye, and you're blind in one eye. And I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense.
I just forgot.
you just don't think about these things when you're writing. You just use yourself, you know.
Yeah.
So maybe subconsciously you're putting yourself in there, maybe in some way. No, because you're not a murderer. Right. So no.
Not the murder bit, but I think you do use yourself without realizing, you know. Mm-hmm. It's a very strange process, and you look at it afterwards and you're like, oh yes, well, okay, that makes sense. And of course that is, you kind of almost disassemble yourself and scatter yourself across the page, and hopefully in a way that makes it readable and exciting.
Yeah, the eye stuff was just awful because the characters like felt it going in. It was like, oh god, this is awful. They were just looking right at the needle or the little knife or whatever it was. Oh, it was bad.
Yeah, it's not great. I mean, yeah, I think that's sort of maybe that, it's also the sacrifice, the deliberate sacrifice of it that makes it so perfect. The idea that someone can just do that because they're so persuaded of certain truths, I think that's almost more frightening than the actual act itself.
Yeah. And they're saying here in the comments, it's beautifully tragic. And I agree with that because it is.
Oh, that's nice.
What has been taken away from all these girls on the island, what could their lives have been had they not been sort of, I don't even necessarily say kidnapped, but just sort of, because some of them were taken from like poor homes and stuff like that. Just what their life could have been as opposed to what they got wrapped up in
It's also a novel of survival, it's about endurance and about finding ways to live with things that shouldn't be livable, and to live to live with the past and a past that's almost unbearable. I think it's definitely a survival story, and it's more about them than it is about what happens to them, if you know what I mean. It's about their will to their will to carry on despite everything, and about their relationships as well. That despite their messed up environment and this terrible immense pressure they're always under and control that's inflicted on them, they still manage to sort of love each other and be sisters and be a family. I find that very moving, and then there's a sort of element of later when Dinah has a sort of found family of her own. There's always a light somewhere, even if it's small and flickering and faint.
Even with her and Eve growing up on the island together, that was sort of a found family. They had that sisterly bond, even though they're not blood sisters and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And there's you can I think you can there's love everywhere if you know how to look for it.
Yeah.
Well, it's sentimental, isn't it? But I think horror has a lot of love in it. And that's what makes it so frightening.
I think there's a lot of found family kind of stuff in horror, and that really shines through in a lot of books, especially, this one with Olive and what was the boy's name, because there's just that one boy on the island as well with Uncle
Abel. Yeah.
He seems sort of outcast compared to everybody else, a bit different.
Well, I think it's mentioned when it's mentioned at some point that Uncle took him because he was little and thin and he thought he was a girl.
Yeah.
So there's a sort of and I think against the backdrop of the First World War, which completely obliterated much of the young male, or indeed just the male population of Europe. There's this sort of counterpoint of some of the suffering that's inflicted on the girls is gendered, but also some of the suffering that's inflicted in the world outside and on Abel is also gendered. So they're sort of counterpoints to each other.
I think I remember Uncle at one point saying he wished he could have taken Abel back, but they wouldn't let him do that. He wanted to get rid of him at that one point.
Yeah. Well, it's a sad story. I mean, I did I did some research for it about orphans and foundlings and familyless children around that time. And I mean, I'm not sure it's that much better today, but there are no good answers really. So the way that they bond together and support, not always, but in general, support each other is kind of their linchpin, their lifeline.
Yeah, and I guess being that they were orphans, I guess maybe they, it sounds weird to say, but maybe they were better off with Uncle than maybe they would have been, but you know, it just depends on what.
You sort of hesitate to say that, but yeah, but yeah, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So where do you normally get your inspiration from? I mean, like true stories, just documentaries, movies, other books?
I mean, everywhere. I usually find that there's a combination of things that set off like a set of synaptic firings in my head. Like with Sundial, it was this combination of doing Mothers and Daughters and then discovering the MK Ultra behavior modification experiments that they did at Langley on the dogs. So, which a lot of people think I made up, and I did not, which is it's something else. But it plays into that idea of playing God. So at Langley, they created essentially a pack of remote controlled dogs. They implanted electrodes in their limbic systems and covered the brain, the exposed skull with little dental cement, little bowler hats of dental cement. And then they would teach the dogs to seek out pleasure impulses so that they could, essentially, like when you pressed a button, the dog would seek out turning left and seek the impulse until it turned right again. You could direct them and make them do very simple things like sit down and fetch and all of that. But it was completely useless and they couldn't find a practical application for it. So after 2 years, when they'd accomplished their aim, they destroyed the dogs and just never revisited it. And you can find all of this information on the Black Vault, which is a big dump site of redacted but declassified CIA documents. And I thought that this was just so...
You're not in a dark web, are you?
No.
Okay.
No, it's freely, freely available. Dark everything, but not dark web.
Yeah.
It sort of offended me. It's a bit, it reminded me of that quote from Jurassic Park of, you were so busy wondering whether you should, you never stopped to think about whether you could. Oh, sorry, you never stopped to think about whether you should. And I just thought that's playing God in a very specific way, isn't it? That's like trying to jump the fence over all the things which make us us. It's trying to control something which obviously is, our behavior is all a combination of genetics and upbringing and free will and all these things. And you're just trying to jump the fence and just like co-opt it and seize control of it. But then there's nothing to do with it. So all of these, this suffering and these six lives were just wasted. So, and that fed back very deeply into Sundial. And because there is some, there's animal experimentation in the book, which I put it in because I think it's horrible and I abhor it. It's true horror for me. But yeah, guys, we're just about to be invaded by two very small, excited children. so I might have to leave you there. But is there anything else? Because I think they're due in 2 minutes. Is there anything else we should talk about before I go?
We just want to really thank you so much for agreeing to do two bozos with microphones and you're chatting it up.
I stalked the interwebs for an email for you and I sent it. It's like she'll never respond. Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh,
I mean we can't thank you enough. I mean, getting all this insight on some of your big books. I mean, I know the horror community loves your work and also we could cross this off as one of our
bucket list authors.
Authors that we want to talk to. So we really appreciate it. Stopping by.
I had a ball. Thank you, and thank you everyone who's been watching and commenting and buying the book. listen, thank you so much again for having me, and lots of love, and maybe we'll talk to you again next year for Looking Glass Sound.
Yeah, absolutely. So where
can people find you, real quick?
Oh yes, I'm so sorry. So I'm on Twitter, Katrina Ward. I don't do DMs because I just,
too many. You'll probably get a billion of them.
It's a jungle out there. and then I always forget my Instagram account. So let me just tell you what it is. Hold on a second. I don't know why my brain is incapable of retaining this information, but it's Kat Ward, CatWard 66. Kat Ward 66 on Insta. And I'm to be found there wasting time most days.
Thank you so much. We totally appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, everyone, thank you so much
for joining us.
Thank you. And have a lovely Saturday, everyone.
Till we meet again. Well. See everybody. See ya.
See ya, Kat. Love you, Jay.
I know.
Love you, Jay.